Welcome to the Cause Effect 4.0 podcast, where we explore the forces reshaping our world through technology, innovation, and human ambition. I'm your host, Alina Lee, and today we're stepping into one of the most urgent conversations of our time. Who gets to shape the future of technology, and what values will guide the digital systems that we rely on? Our guest today has dedicated his career to answering questions exactly like these, Ambassador Philip Tigo, Kenya's special envoy on technology, is at the forefront of global technology diplomacy, negotiating how artificial intelligence, data, and emerging technology should be governed in an era where digital power is as consequential as geopolitical power. As we enter this new chapter, we must ask, can Africa influence global AI policy rather than simply absorb it? And how do we make emerging technologies safe, inclusive, and trustworthy to every citizen, not just the privileged few? Ambassador Tigo advises the President of Kenya on critical technologies, supports the Ministry of Foreign Affairs in high-stakes global negotiations, and builds strategic partnerships that reinforce Kenya's reputation as the heart of Silicon Savannah. His work spans diplomacy, innovation, global governance, and development. From serving on the UN Secretary General's high-level advisory body on AI, to helping establish Digital Earth Africa. Ambassador Philip Tigo, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much, Celine.
You describe your role as advancing tech diplomacy for Kenya. So what is tech diplomacy? How does it look like in practice? And why is it becoming a core pillar of modern foreign policy?
I think previously there's been a couple of iterations of technology diplomacy in terms of the definitions. But when we were crafting this role, we sort of understood that the world is changing. Previous technology diplomats were very much focused around cyber diplomacy, I think, because at that time, a lot of the interactions between member states and negotiations were very much around cybersecurity. But then when the president appointed me into this role, we had a larger conversation based on Kenya's historical engagement around technology, right from the early days of the World Summit on Information Society in Tunisia, to actually begin to understand a couple of things. One is that technology in this current iteration impacts how we live, learn, work, communicate. So it's impacting all aspects of life. So not just one aspect, which is cybersecurity. And the second part is that we also have a realization, and this is something that we learned from Denmark, is that companies are currently potentially as large as the size of countries, if not bigger. And the current multilateral system does not necessarily incorporate companies. Yet companies, despite their large size capabilities around resources, they also have influence. They impact populations across borders. But in most cases, they actually set technology policy outside the realm of international diplomacy. And so my role then begins to be that bridge in recognition of these new realities, right? That you must have a dedicated person who engages technology companies, but also you have a dedicated person who understands that we live in an era of technology, not only the technology itself being the angle of engagement, but basically interacting across countries, companies, private sector, civil society, innovators on the impacts of technology, whether negative or positive on society. And so you need somebody who does that, and diplomacy is the tool that we think we have to do that, because part of what we're doing is exploration and engagement.
Yeah, it's kind of like a whole different slice cut in a horizontal diagonal kind of way. So you often say that Kenya must build technology that reflects our values. What exactly are Kenya's digital values, and how does it differ from the tech philosophies that come out of Silicon Valley, Brussels, or Beijing?
Because if you think about African values, has always been around community, has always been around inclusivity. has always been around solidarity. It's always been around sharing. So we sort of, I would say, built a sharing economy before anybody did it. Unfortunately, a lot of these technologies are built within the concept of a race, right? It's to the extent of whoever has it controls. African values are not about controls. It's always about enabling environments, ecosystems, individuals, communities, societies. I mean, we are potentially the only continent that talks about collective rights or collective capability. Everybody else speaks about individual aspirations. And so we do not see the two separate, but we believe one cannot develop if the community doesn't develop. And that's the concept of Ubuntu, right? And so I think for us, we think Kenya's values, which are African values, bring a very different ethos into technology in a way that the technology can benefit the whole of society, because the minute it is built for only those who can or those who have, then it negates the value of inclusivity, but also benefits of all of society.
Yeah. So how does that translate into policy, into the priorities that you're advancing in Kenya?
So if you think about, I mean, we are builders, right? So if you think about building blocks, right? If the foundation is wrong, then chances are that anything you build on top of the foundation is off. And so for us, the translation of it means even how we design policies about inclusivity. So we start from a conversation. We start from engagement and public participation. We come from co-design and co-creation. And so that's how you build from the bottom up, as the president says, or from the ground up. And in that way, you become inclusive from the get-go. Right, it negates the other concept of build and they'll come, right? So it's a very different a very different approach to Brexit.
Yeah, no, that's amazing. So we know that Kenya contributes only, or sorry, Africa contributes only 2% of global AI training data. What does true data sovereignty look like on the continent then? And how do we start to move beyond rhetoric into actual actions? What does this start to look like?
I mean, it's weird, but I kind of been saying it for a couple of years that maybe this is a good thing, that we potentially do not yet have a lot of data, African data in AI, because chances are that we will not be the ones who ingested that data into those AI systems. If it happened before, at least now we have countries that have a semblance or sort of some form of data protection capability, which means that that's for me the first building block of sovereignty. Like countries have designed and developed data protection regimes that then protects data, which means training AI using African data right now at least has some form of safeguards and guardrails. And so I think for me, that's the beginning of sovereignty. So kind of the policy pillar. The other pillar, which is something that I think Zindi is very good at, is talent. Because how you safeguard sovereignty, but also how sovereignty in many ways is ingrained in the DNA of AI. Because sovereignty is not about, it's not one aspect. It's the entire AI stack. And so it means that the talent that in itself builds AI through the entire AI stack must itself be sovereign, to the extent that it's only a local person who will understand the nuances of some certain context or even language, right? So I speak Kiswahili, but I don't speak the other 42 languages that Kenyans speak. So even to that extent, it means sovereignty must also be about linguistic diversity and languages, but also the talent that then works around building these AI systems or these language models must also be local enough. It can be collaborative. And part of what I always say is that let us not confuse the definition of sovereignty in AI with the classic definition of sovereignty. We constantly define, in our view, sovereignty as independence, but in an era of interdependence. And that, for me, should be the definition, because it means I can still build my systems, but those systems are interoperable with other systems, because we are part of a global community. So it's not about being isolationist. It's about being realistic around countries. To the extent that countries, honestly, own their own intelligence. I really do not believe that people should be outsourcing their intelligence. And that for me is a threat to sovereignty. That no country, no individual, no person in Africa should outsource their intelligence. Because if you don't have those capabilities, that's what you do. And if intelligence is the currency of the future, what does that mean for sovereignty in the future?
Yes, yeah. So you mentioned a little bit about, I mean, in a way you're saying Africa has like a second comer advantage a bit in the sense like you're not sorry, you're coming to deep end, but not quite in the same way that maybe before dialogues about safety, data protection, were happening.
And if you think about that data, right? So if you think about, I mean, and I'll be part of this safety conversation. So I'll be very honest. Part of what my team has refused, and we had a lot of clusters in terms of what you need to work on. And it was interesting that there was a works team on synthetic data, right? But to Africans, we've not run out of data to start training synthetic data. We've not, right? And so for me, that's why I say we sort of have a second come advantage in this, that potentially because a lot of our data sets are not yet ingested in any AI model, then maybe it's an advantage to set the rules and the conditions within which our data sets can be ingested.
Yeah, I am actually curious. I mean, you're talking about data sets. What is right now the stance of, in the Kenyan government or that you've been seeing? I mean, where do you see the idea of collecting more data, you know, building foundational models on local languages? Swahili is one of the largest spoken languages in Africa. So I always say when people ask me about it, I always say, well, Swahili is probably the first candidate, for a locally grown foundational model. But but what is your stance on it? What do you think the advantages or, potential is?
My stand is basically, and again, part of the conversations, unfortunately, that are in Africa are never African-led or do not necessarily begin in the continent. So at some point, this was the conversation, but you realize it was very much driven by big tech companies, right, in terms of local languages. But you and I understand that a lot of our languages are not written. Our languages are oral, and they're not, and we don't, and it's not about language, it's also dialects. Because Kiswahili is a broad term, but it has many dialects. The Kiswahili spoken in Kenya is not the one spoken in Uganda, Tanzania. So my position has been that we need to have a conversation, especially folks who are pushing these directions around building, these Swahili models. It's Swahili is not homogeneous, right? As I said, it has very different dialects. So our position has been around linguistic diversity. And around building potentially smaller models, but more diverse language data sets that are more inclusive and speak to our reality, which is more audiovisual, not necessarily written. I can't write many things in Swahili. I'm sorry, I'm honest. I can't because our languages are never written. And so I think that that reality that we must begin to reinforce.
Yes. Okay, so we were talking about AI safety. A lot of the debates on AI safety have been largely dominated by the US, by Europe. Where should Africa place itself in these global negotiations? Is Africa a rule taker, a co-author, or a challenger?
It depends on which country. We have 54 countries. For Kenya, and I'll speak for my country, fortunately, we've been part of all the conversations and we are all of it, right? Because at some point you realize you have to take a position of enrollment. At some point you have to challenge because you're challenging notions and assumptions that folks have around safety. Sometimes we don't even agree on the definition of safety because potentially, people come into these rooms from either protectionist. It depends, right? Any country that potentially already has advanced frontier models, of course, we look at safety very differently. Our countries that do not have any, we look at potential harms of those technologies and societies, so they look at safety very differently. And so I think for me, I see us in the three, but fundamentally, as Africans, I think, and spoken through the AUAI strategy has been very clear, right, around how we view the impacts of artificial intelligence on society. And that's basically our safety first approach, that AI should not do any harm to society from that sense, because when you go to other countries, then they look at safety in terms of their models and then they add a security element of it, but we don't have those for now. And that's why I'm saying it will potentially be gradual, but I think at this instance, our approach is, because the models are external, it should not necessarily harm society.
Right. And but when you're you know, thinking about making sure that Africa and Kenya have a seat at the table, I'm curious. I mean, you were on the UN High Level Advisory Body on AI. How can global governance be truly inclusive when certain countries enter these negotiations from a position that is perhaps unequal, you know, in terms of power, negotiating leverage, capital? How do you see that working?
Well, unfortunately, I mean, and this has been my experience in the last 3, 4 years, that I think everybody understands what artificial intelligence is. Artificial intelligence is power. It's power to reshape society, it's power to advance economies, it's powers to sort of transition into the next phase of I think human evolution. And that is not easily shared. And so what you've seen in the first or initial iterations of AI global governance has been very much around the groupings, right? So G77, G20, sorry, G7, G20. Only I think UNESCO, UN AI ethics principles, right, is when we saw a sort of a multi-stakeholder kind of inclusive process. And because that was the United Nations, that you had more than 100 countries at least participate. And then we tried to take this into the United Nations through the various revolutions with safe security, with the safe, secure, inclusive AI for sustainable development in March of last year. Then the capacity building one in Zambia and China. Then, of course, the Global Digital Compact and the various issues that have come out of that, which is the AI scientific panel and the global dialogue mechanisms. But you realize a lot of these things are not legally binding. It's very much aspiration, right? So, and potentially they are not enforceable. So I think we are that situation right now, that there's an aspiration, but a lot of this is not enforceable and depends a lot on international goodwill and solidarity. And maybe, and this is something that Kenya has been talking about in most cases and through my president, to the extent of how do we reform the current international order in a way that is inclusive, because it's really not about AI, it's about the international order. AI is just the current topic of discussion. And unless we reform that, then there'll be a problem. This year was actually UN 80, right? We are very clear that none of us was in San Francisco in 1940s. We were probably recruited to fight the Second World War. We didn't even have borders and we were probably colonized, even when the UN was being put together. So there has to be a proper conversation to reform the international order now that even African states are emancipated, so that the international order works for everybody. So whichever topic comes into play, then all of us have an equal voice, regardless of who has the power, money, or influence. And that was what I think we were trying to envision in the UN advisory body. And I think we pulled it off based on the report that we produced. But again, a report is a report. Ultimately, it has to be implemented. And when it gets into implementation, of course, then they'll be selective, cherry picking on what works or doesn't work.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that what came out for me from the report, I mean, I guess it's been a year now, but I remember something that struck me is just the what's different about AI is that interdependency, that there are no borders anymore. There's no such thing as this is my country, this is your country. You actually have to create, yeah, a framework that works at a global level. So in a way, yeah, the countries that are perhaps at a you know, at a, you know, from starting from an unequal footing, still have equal footing in the sense that what they do will affect everyone else. What everyone else does will affect them.
That's
Everyone
okay.
has to be at the table and come along on the journey, right? And it
Yeah,
has to
I
work
mean,
for everyone.
that's the thing. And how about the pandemic, right? And that's the point. And I always tell people the pandemic probably prepared us for AI, because we understood, right? We understood how interconnected we are, and we seem to have had a good use case, but we're not
Yes.
extrapolating it now to understand that I'm sorry, the genie is out of the bottle. You know, if AI becomes agentic or gains agency in one part of the world, it's going to affect all of us, right? And so
Yes.
it's something that we need to put in our heads.
Yeah, you can't have one country just running wild and
It doesn't
everyone
work. It doesn't work. It doesn't. I'm
It
telling
is
folks, I'm
always
sorry. It doesn't work. I'm sorry. You can be in a little mountain, but I'm sorry, your mountain won't last long.
Yeah.
It just doesn't work.
No, I mean, it's amazing work that you did at the with the advisory body. And I was impressed. I think it was a very inclusive, it seemed like a very inclusive body as well. So when you and I first met many years ago, you were working on Earth observation. I think that was the first project that maybe we started talking about, the data. So you've been working on Earth observation data, on I think maybe digital IDs. I'm curious, kind of the on these different projects, these very kind of really tangible projects that you've been working on. What potential do you see? Why are they important for you? What potential do you see for kind of solving last mile problems in Africa?
Interesting enough, if you look at observations, satellite data and Earth observations, right? I think they could easily solve about 11 of the 17 SDGs if you just get your satellite data and Earth observations right, whether it's education, whether it's schools, whether it's just geographically mapping folks, including people, right? So before we actually got into working with the big players like Esri and the rest, we actually were one of the first people to map Kibera. Because Kibera was never mapped. And just learning from that with OpenStreetMaps and mapping Kibera, we could start to understand service delivery gaps. And so I think for me, to your point, you can actually see that things like satellite data and Earth observations can make communities that are previously invisible visible. And we know that because you can also layer that. But secondly, it also can create a community layer where communities can map or sort of curate things that matter for them. Because we've seen previously, before citizen scientists, it was cartographers or geographers who mapped areas. And in those cases, they did not necessarily map important things for that community. And that's why I think satellite data and Earth observations is very important, especially for Africans, right? Because I want Google Maps or Google's mapping to maps. But if whatever they've mapped is not important to me, and more important for tourists than it does matter. And so I think part of what I see some of the Earth observations is the idea of democratizing information, but also democratizing curation of information and putting it in a map that anyone else in the world can access. And so I think for us, I still believe satellite data Earth observations becomes a base layer of conversations around data and inclusivity.
Yes, amazing. I mean, you've been, well, Kenya brands itself as Silicon Savannah. and you've been deeply involved on some of the projects on the ground as well as on a global level. What makes you feel optimistic and excited about Kenya and Kenya's role in the global AI ecosystem?
I think there's interesting pieces, right? The first thing I think excitement, I think, for me is leadership. Because the one thing that I think I've been speaking for many years, including my stint at Arizona State University with Thunderbird School, was that the market will take care of the engineers. It will, and I think they are fine. Where we have a problem is the leadership, especially in an era of uncertainty and acceleration. And so I think for me, the excitement I have is that we actually have a leadership, but also clearly a culture that I'm seeing of leadership that is beginning to understand this sort of specific nuances and being able to then make the right investments, decisions, but also understanding that in this era of acceleration, you need to be very agile. And agility means inclusivity and consultation. It may be slow or rigorous or seems like it's bogging you down, but ultimately in this era, you really have to engage everyone. So I think for me, that's the biggest excitement I have, just the notion of leadership. The second one, of course, is very much around what I'm increasingly seeing as talent. And I think that's why Zindi, I think, spends quite some time in Kenya, because they seem to be passion around harnessing capabilities so that we can build products that speak to realities that we have and kind of this problem-solving mindset. So we have a talent that has a problem-solving mindset. So it's just not a talent for talent's sake. We have more than 300,000 folks on GitHub. Of course, with Zindi numbers, we Kenyans still a majority of folks in Zindi. So I think for me, the talent 8, is good. Yeah.
Yeah, 8,000 on Zindi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I that's mean, a big one. Yeah. It's exciting, right?
Yeah.
It's exciting. Yes, it's exciting. And it's collaborative, right? So it's just not talent individually. It's talent that I am beginning to see is very collaborative. So people are getting into spaces, this community. So it's talent, but it's community of talent, right? And I think that's exciting. So it's not individual folks in corners and laptops. It's very much, you know, it's very much a community, which is exciting.
Yes, I agree. And yeah, and problem solving and community, those are like two really strong like characteristics of the developers that we see on Zindi. And positions Kenya very uniquely in this global space. So just a final question, as you look ahead in 10 years, what must Africa get right to ensure that AI helps close the digital divide rather than
it? Will we be there in 10 years? I want to see the next 1 year. timing is important. I think, again, and I'll come back to the AI stack, right? We need to get it right. That first of all, AI is not an ICT issue. AI is a whole of society issue. It affects everything in our lives. So I think we need to change that mindset. For me, that's the baseline. If we change that, then I think we have a good foundation for the next 10 years. Because it means we understand that we need to invest in compute. We need to invest in talent. We need to invest in the critical infrastructure like energy. We need to invest in the leadership that does this. But I think finally, we need to invest in the use cases. We need to test it out from a risk-based approach so that we can see both the impacts, but also opportunities and harms of AI in a way that we continue to ensure that it benefits society and not to be basically afraid that AI will take over jobs or people lose jobs. So I think for me, that's, we need to get that right.
Amazing. Okay, well, that's all the questions I have. Thank you so much. Thanks for being in the hall with me. And I appreciate your partnership. Kenya's doing an amazing job, and we're always so happy at Zindi to be working with you. So thank you.
Thanks so much, Sally. Take care.